Record, it's 5 minutes past one. In attendance are Representative Holmes, Representative Gatto, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Herron, Representative Ramris, Representative Dahlstrom. We anticipate Representative Lynn coming into the room anytime. At the request of some members, we have set aside House Bill 298, the crime bill. Until Monday, when Andy Carpinetti is going to be back. And I would just like to share with the group, just so that we can stay on that subject grounded, in why we are focusing on these issues. As this group knows, I have excuse me just for a second. I have, as this committee knows, I have private sector interests, and the front desk manager at the hotel sent me a note this morning at 10:54 a.m. It says, "Hello, I hope this finds you well. I need to tell you that Rachel, who's our night auditor, a mother with three children, who is married to a military man, is still married to him. I need to tell you that Rachel had to quit suddenly. I do have another night auditor that started training last night. She had to flee to a safe place to escape domestic violence."
Oh, jeez.
So if you contemplate that, not only in the workplace and the home, but you can see. So when we take up House Bill 298, we certainly are doing it grounded in real reasons why we take up these things that affect people across all walks of life, and then affect the training costs for any business that has to replace somebody who leaves suddenly without notice, who's a highly qualified worker and uniquely trained. I mean, it has an economic effect. It has an effect on the household. It has an effect on the small children. This is a woman who's thousands of miles away from her immediate support network because she was married military. Her husband got out of the service. The family stayed in Fairbanks, and they're on a road system. Unlike many of the, Fairbanks has a road system, unlike many of the communities that we talk about. Representative Lynn has joined us. Representative Lynn, we're going to watch this if you want to seat yourself here next to James. And so Representative Holmes, when I said next to James, I meant next to James so that you could. That's what I meant. So we will take up that bill on Monday. We understand that the Department of Public Safety may have an amendment. I think Representative Dahlstrom has an amendment. We still have Representative Gatto's amendment before us, and then the unresolvable double jeopardy amendment. And we'll see what Andy Carpinetti's thoughts are on that, and then we will attempt to move that bill from this committee shortly. I did call the Attorney General and let him know that in no way were we embargoing that piece of legislation, that we were anxious to move it from this committee, but that we wanted to do so responsibly.
Sure.
So the first bill before us today is the first piece of business before us today is House Joint Resolution Number 8. Representative Kelly is here along with Derek Miller, who's technical director. Gentlemen, welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a House Finance Committee that I'll move off to after a bit, but I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill so early in the session. It's very timely because this bill's been in a bit of a holding pattern, waiting for the right moment to strike. And over on the House side, we have formed a committee of the Finance Committee that is called the Long-Range Fiscal Policy Committee. It's going to be chaired by Representative Osterman, and he's itching to get started on that. Also, a discussion with the co-chair of Finance indicates that this bill would be given a look. And so, once again, Mr. Chairman, hats off to you for having it so early in the session when you got a lot of people bearing down on you to get their bills here.
In the interest of liberty.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Just on that point, we don't have a Ways and Means Committee this year. Is this subcommittee sort of doing the same kind of thing the Ways and Means did?
My feeling is that there's a bit of that in there, but that it is more narrowly focused on long-term fiscal policy.
Is it only
open?
Is it only, thank you, is it only open to members of the Finance Committee?
It is the Finance Committee of the whole, are the members? Through the chair, Mr.
Thank you.
or Representative Bloomberg.
We try to maintain the same protocol here that you have in the Finance Committee, and we appreciate you reciprocating.
And those of us renegades.
Representative Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's a committee of the whole of the Finance Committee.
Through the Chair, it is, yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herring.
Yes, thank you, sir. Is that when Representative Osterman stood up today on the floor, though, he extended the invitation to include all members of the House in at least the organizational meeting that will be coming up.
Unfortunately, we don't have before us today the structure of the committee that will be taking up. What we have is HJR 8, which is before the House Judiciary Committee. We are delighted to have you here to present this to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so HJR 8, some of you were exposed to it last year briefly, but I'll just state what it, a couple of things. In 1982 and again in 1990, the people of Alaska attempted to limit our appetite for spending by amending the Constitution relative to the constitutional spending limit and later on the constitutional budget reserve, which required a three-quarter vote for stuff left over from the previous year to spend that. So what this bill does is, in my opinion, those two bills or those two amendments have not quite gotten where we need to be. What this bill would do is it would take a five-year average, four looking back and one looking ahead, of the mineral revenue, which is chiefly petroleum revenue, and it would say that that is a five-year average of those, an average of those 5 years would be available in any given year for appropriation. And what it would do then is create, in years when there are funds above that five-year average available, those funds would go into the balanced budget account. And when in years when there are insufficient funds to get up to the level of the five-year average for appropriations, the legislature, in both cases by just a majority vote, would be able to withdraw from the balanced budget account. And so it is essentially a utility business, you'd call it a day tank. It's a smaller tank out here, and it's used to supplement, to receive funds when we've got excess revenues, and to provide funds when we are short for balancing the budget. And it has a fill level. When it is equal to 2 years' worth of appropriations, then that money that is in excess of 2 years, the last 2 years of appropriations, would go to the Constitutional Budget Reserve account. Fairly simple mechanism that attempts to average the amount available instead of having the spikes and peaks. And as Derek leads you through the PowerPoint presentation, you will see exactly how it works. But I've mentioned the timing of it. What I'd like to certainly like to do is be able to get this over to the Finance Committee, and from the hilltop view, what it does as far as averaging revenue available to us, hopefully to discipline our appetite for in years when we have excess revenues, maybe spending a bit too much, and in years when we just don't have the revenues. It's only a year ago that oil was at $30 briefly. Then we cut. And so, Mr. Chairman, with that, if I might turn it over to Derek Miller and have him walk you through the slide presentation quickly. And
thank you.
I'd like to stick with you for a while in case there are questions of the sponsor.
Enjoy having you.
For the record, my name is Derek Miller, staff to Representative Kelly. And before you today is HJR 8. And simply put, HJR 8 is a proposed 2010 amendment to the state constitution that provides a limit on appropriations of revenue derived from mineral resources. And mineral revenue includes mineral lease rentals, royalties, bonuses, and production taxes on oil and gas. If put on the ballot in 2010 and passed by voters, the amendment would apply to appropriations made in fiscal year 2012 and thereafter. And as Representative Kelly mentioned, in 1982, voters approved an amendment to the Alaska Constitution to control state spending, and they established that appropriation limit at $2.5 billion plus adjustments for changes in population and inflation. So in today's dollars, For FY08, as an example, the Office of Management and Budget estimated that limit to be approximately $7.9 billion. And actually, the updated CAFR, Comprehensive Annual Financial Statement for the state for FY09 puts that at $8.3 billion. So, in effect here, we're either doing a great job of controlling government growth, or we're it's completely ineffective. In FY08, the budget that passed by the legislature after vetoes was $5.5 billion, or $2.4 billion less than that constitutional spending limit that we established back in 1982. In 1990, the people of Alaska...
Back up one slide. Thank you.
In 1990, the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, was created in an attempt to control spending, and this voters approved this constitutional amendment, and it would take a three-quarters vote basically to get money out of the CBR. So in essence, they were attempting to make it more difficult for the legislature to appropriate money. So going back to 1990, when the CBR was created, and adjusting the actual general fund spending that year for inflation, spending that year, by the way, was about $2.3 billion, less than the $2.5 billion established in the spending limit 8 years before. This graph depicts that and uses an inflation rate of 3%, which was recommended by the Legislative Finance Division, and you can see that we'd be right around $4 billion currently. Actual GF spending is added to that first line, and spending includes operating budget, the capital budget, statewide appropriations, which includes debt service, fund caps, revenue sharing, and direct appropriations to the retirement system. So you can see historically in the last 20 years what the actual GF spending beginning in FY90 would have been adjusted for inflation, and then what we actually spent in those years. Now, this slide adds actual GF revenue, and this includes non-mineral, and this is, it includes non-mineral so that we can have an apples-to-apples comparison. And you can see the wild fluctuations in recent years, especially in FY08, when we had over $10 billion in revenue, mostly due to that $150 barrel of oil, as we all are well aware. And finally, this slide includes what would have happened had HDR 8 been implemented back in this. It condenses it to 10 years instead of 20 years beginning in 2000. And you can see every year since 2000 that HDR 8, that non-mineral, or excuse me, the mineral revenue spending limit would have imposed a limit on how much the legislature could spend in any given year. We would be less in every single year except in FY10. We would have had available a little spot there to include money from the balanced budget account, which I'll get into in a later slide. This is probably my favorite slide in this presentation because it's a pretty simple way to understand what this bill does. On the left-hand column is revenue from oil after the permanent fund is paid. The five-year average there you can see is in the blue. So on the column on the right here, we have created the balanced budget account. So when revenue is low, after you've calculated this five-year average, which is 4 years going back and 1 year going forward, once that's been calculated, if actual revenue coming into the state from minerals is less than that, we can transfer money from that balanced budget account on the right in order to flush up the difference depicted in red there.
Chairman, Derek made that slide, which might account for that being his favorite one.
Derek, why do you say minerals instead of oil and gas? Were you talking about gold? When you say minerals, what comprises minerals?
There's a actually in the bill. I think it's on the first page. It includes mineral lease rentals, royalties, bonuses, production taxes on oil and gas. So it's not just oil and gas. It's the state's natural resources, mineral natural resources.
Plus insurance and tobacco, or is it, does it exclude that? Is it?
It's supposed to be directed towards the 90% of the revenue that the state receives from minerals, from oil and gas, from minerals, that the 90% that we all talk about our state relying on, the most volatile component. It leaves the other components out, because those are generally more stable. So that's what we're attempting to do with this, is deal just with that most volatile component. Does that make sense, Mr. Chairman?
It makes sense. It just, it does make sense. It just feels like then everything else, the other 8% of state income then comprises the base load or the base amount before you factor in the, I'm just trying to understand.
Conversely, if sure. we actually.
Representative Gatto?
Yeah. Question out of a microphone.
Use a microphone, please.
The supplemental budget, or budgets, as we have those, are those outside of this plan?
That's a good question, Representative Gatto, through the chair. I'd have to get back with you on that. And we do have Mr. Teal available, and then Ms. Tam Cook, I believe,
Cook
available.
Is with us also, right. And honestly, when we're in the Finance Committee, we do observe a certain kind of protocol when we address the chair, and we do try to maintain that here. So if I could just ask you to it's important, I think. But I have the rules chair here. I don't want to bust you.
Okay.
And I will.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Because I've snitched out a lot of members on the soft drinks already. Okay. And the next thing I'll go after is protocol, because I'm crazy that way.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you,
go
Mr.
ahead,
Chair. Conversely, if the revenue that we actually receive from the state is in excess of the five-year average, whatever is above that five-year average gets transferred into the balanced budget account and is reserved for when we receive less revenue than we expect. Is there any questions on that slide? The HDR 8 does not touch the sacred cows, so to speak. It does not touch the permanent fund dividend, the permanent fund corpus, the permanent fund earnings, or Amaretta Hess. It is not subject to the constitutional budget reserve sweep. And finally here, we get into a simple visual of how we calculate the five-year average. And we use these figures from the Department of Revenue's resources book for FY10. And this is an example of trying to come up with a number for FY10 budget purposes. We take the 4 years back, which we know how much revenue the state received, and the 1 year that we're currently in, the fiscal year that we're currently in. And if we're planning for FY10 like we were last year, we were currently in FY09. And we estimate how much money the state was going to receive from mineral revenue. And we take those 5 years and we average them out for your five-year average. And here's an example of what those figures actually look like for the FY10 budget last year that we were planning on. We actually, the five-year average was actually more than what was available, what the estimated availability of funds from mineral resources was. Another visual here, making an attempt to discuss the relationships between the balanced budget account and the constitutional budget reserved. The balanced budget account is limited to a maximum amount equal to oil appropriations for 2 years. Any excess would be transferred to the CBR. So the five-year limit times two, basically. If we have obtained more revenue in that account in excess of that 2 years, then the excess will be transferred to the constitutional budget reserve. It'll spill over into the constitutional budget reserve.
Now, procedural question. The balanced budget account, does that include capital or is it just for operating?
As far as availability of funds?
Correct.
It's, yes, I believe so, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, it does include the capital budget.
Okay, so here's my question then. Here's my procedural question. And forgive me for being a little bit partisan in my question. But we're just now wrestling with forward funding education this year because we couldn't do it last year because we ran into a procedural issue with
three-quarter vote
and partisanship on the floor. So my question is that if is there an unintended consequence of moving money into the CBR and then finding ourselves does the HJR 8 come in so far as c- controlling the brinksmanship that tends to happen when you have to go into the CBR, and we've all been through, David Teal could tell us many battle stories about what transpires when we do that. Does this have a safety net, say, over that to prevent, you know, rape and pillage from happening, you know, in order to get the secure the three-quarter vote?
Mr. Chairman, it might mitigate the rape and pillage situation by having the day tank available if you're short of revenue, but it will stop you from using that day tank unless you have that situation where you're short of funding. So I would say that in a normal year, let's just say you're not short, you would find pretty much the same situation that you have now, because to go grab something, you know, not off budget, but something like that $1 billion that you're talking about, Mr. Chairman, you would have to access the constitutional budget reserve, and that will not change that three-quarter vote situation.
Okay. The last remaining slides, real quickly here, fiscal responsibility. This just encourages a better budgeting system than when you have it, spend it, when you don't cut. And it's relatively simple and easy to understand. And it eliminates the need for complicated rat-holing or parking of excess funds to avoid a three-quarter vote. Why a constitutional amendment? Simply because the legislature can easily overpower, ignore, or change statutory appropriation constraints, and it also allows the people to speak concerning this simple framework.
Okay, is that it?
Two more slides, Mr. Chairman. In relation to the percent of market value, if the people of Alaska choose a percent of market value approach to funding government using the permanent fund earnings, then HJR 8 accommodates this approach. And final slide here are just excerpts from a December 19th, 2007, Bradner's Alaska Legislative Digest that I won't read off the screen, but you can, are provided for the committee to read.
Okay.
Perfect. If you hit the lights, let's just take your brief at ease and just get my room put back together here. Everybody. Good. We have Dana Olson. Oh, I see she's on for HJR 8. Is available. Tam Cook is here. David Teal, who has great institutional knowledge, is here. We're going to lose Representative Kelly shortly. Do any members have any specific questions for Representative Kelly on HJR 8? Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's conceivable that special drum with labeled yellow that requires a three-quarter vote could grow exponentially, because it's rare to have a three-quarter majority, and then you're always fighting to find the support to take money out of there, and then you have to give away capital projects to get the support. I'm sure you looked into all of that. That three-quarter vote is it's a bar that none of us can really reach unless we own the majority, a three-quarter majority. So that might just be a huge fund in itself.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, the tank that we're talking about has an upper limit of 2 times the 5-year average. So let's just say somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 million. So it automatically hits a flow switch and runs that cash over to the CBR. So we have provided for that. And Mr. Chairman, what the smaller tank does is give you that reserve to put money into and take it out in the normal process of balancing the budget and averaging the spending.
So I think what I'm going to do in a moment is I'm going to ask Tam, from her point of view, what she thinks our jurisdiction is on this. So we certainly, as members of the legislature, we are entitled to, and I encourage our intellectual curiosity on this bill, and yet this constitutional amendment has been referred to the Judiciary Committee, so presumably the litmus test that we have is to test it through that lens, and then, you know, on whatever expedition we want to go in just to better comprehend it ourselves. But the test here, I would suggest to the committee, is really the test of the Judiciary Committee more than it's a test of whether this meets the bar that we would presume if we were sitting on finance. It's not the seat that we have. And so I would encourage members to, you know, to cast your net of intellectual curiosity wherever you like, but when we contemplate moving this bill today, and Representative Kelly, you have my support to move this bill out of committee, that we do that through the lens of does it pass the test that the Judiciary Committee has been assigned. So if we, as long as we can try and set that as a framework, then I certainly encourage members to proceed with any questions that they have. Gentlemen, ladies?
Sounds good.
So Tam, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chair.
And Tam, if you could, thank you, Representative Kelly. If you could answer that question for us. If we are certainly we're all members of the State House and have that vantage point. But in what regard should we be? What paradigm should we be testing HJR 8 as the impaneled Judiciary Committee of the House, in your opinion?
Well, Mr. Chair, are you asking whether there? I would think that the Judiciary Committee might want to know if there are potential legal problems with this constitutional amendment, and might also. I know there were some questions from the committee about the language involving mineral revenue, and I could certainly shed a little bit of light on that language if that was something that the committee was concerned about. Also,
is that helpful to members?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Please, if you would give us your thoughts, please, and then
okay.
Hang on 1 second, Tam, and then David, okay. If you could just be thinking about this for me, is the chronological sequence that we saw was a 1982 amendment that would take the cap up to $7.4 billion, and then we saw a 1990 amendment that put in the CBR. So the question I would have for you is. Then replacing the $7.4 billion then with this new formula, but with the CBR already in place, does that pose any unintended consequences or any problems? Because now the sequence has changed. The CBR is in place, so this amendment now wouldn't replace the CBR constitutional amendment. So if you can just kind of contemplate that so I don't come to you cold with that. Okay, Tam, go ahead, please.
Okay, just Mr. Chair, for the satisfaction of your members who are interested in the mineral language, which is in the very first section of the bill on page 1 at lines 7 through 9, that language right up into to the point where it starts speaking in terms of state taxes. But the language that precedes that is directly out of the permanent fund language. Executive branch, and I expect the court system, has some experience in construing that language as to what sources are in fact dedicated under it. Once you get on line 9 to the mention of a state tax, the state tax portion, that would be new to this constitutional amendment. The permanent fund currently does not dedicate any portion of a state tax. With respect to your the second piece that you asked me to look at, Mr. Chair, which has to do with potential legal problems, I think maybe not all, but very many constitutional amendments that the legislature is faced with considering proposing at this point are laboring under a cloud that was created by the Bess v. Ulmer case, which was decided in 1999, and that is the case that I know all of your members are pretty familiar with, that involved a decision by the Supreme Court limiting the power of the legislature to propose certain types of constitutional amendments that the court identified as being revisions rather than appropriate, simple amendments. Under Bess v. Ulmer, I think it's very difficult under the reasoning of that case to predict the outcome of any particular challenge. And there's very little that I can see that the legislature can do to shield itself from the possibility of scrutiny under Bess v. Ulmer if the legislature is interested in proposing a constitutional amendment. Having said that, there are a couple of things that the case Bess v. Ulmer identified as basically methods that it claimed that it would be using in determining whether the legislature is proposing an acceptable constitutional amendment or an overbroad revision of the state constitution. And one of those was that the proposed constitutional amendment needs to satisfy a single subject. I think there is no problem with that piece of it with HJR 8. And the other one was that it be relatively simple and easy to comprehend. Well, this one is a bit complicated, but I'm not convinced that it violates that piece of it. But there was also language in the Best v. Ulmer case that said that a proposed constitutional amendment to be valid could not seriously alter a basic governmental function of one of the major branches of government. And it is that piece that is a little bit problematical, and I think we could run into a Best v. Ulmer challenge on. And that has to do with the fact that it would be hard to argue that the power of appropriation is anything other than a very basic power of the legislative branch of government. To the extent that this constitutional amendment would successfully restrict that power, which is the goal of the amendment itself, I point out, then you have the question of whether the court would find that it too painfully erodes a fundamental power of the legislative branch of government. And that I see as the most difficult legal question that this particular resolution faces.
Interesting. Questions for Tam Cook from members? Bob, Representative Herron?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tam, I guess that so in your second part of your testimony is using that court case, is you're saying that not specific to any language within HJR 8, it's more of obviously the intent of the sponsor to create this day tank, is the way he's articulated it, is that it's in the whole that you're giving the Judiciary Committee advice and or warning.
Through the chair, I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, I guess it would, through the chair, Tam, is that what I'm hearing is that you have some concern about the overall, I guess, ratcheting down or eroding of the appropriation power of the legislature by this. Though you understand its intent, you're just in the overall, based upon that case that you mentioned, it is just a further erosion of their singular power, the most important singular power?
If I may, through the chair, essentially that is correct. I don't feel that I'm in a position, and I expect there are a few people who do feel that they're in a position, to guess what the court will do based on what we know in Best v. Ulmer. There hasn't been a case since then that has further clarified our Supreme Court's position on those issues. So I am not in a position to tell you that this resolution, if passed the way it is before you today, would be overturned in a court. But I think it is susceptible to challenge. And the challenge would be based on the notion that the power of the legislature to appropriate money is such a significant power that it ought not to be eroded through constitutional amendment. Now, having said that, I think I would hasten to point out that we've got several constitutional amendments that predate the Ulmer decision that do indeed radically erode the legislative power of appropriation. And those are the creation of the permanent fund, which placed a great deal of money outside of the appropriation process indefinitely, forever, as to the balance. The creation of the budget reserve fund, which imposes a higher vote level in order to reach the money in most situations. And in fact, the existing appropriation limit that we have in the Constitution now, the one that we have heard is ineffective because it's set at too high of a level. So we have three amendments that are part of the Constitution that were adopted before the Bessie-Ulmer case came up that perhaps, arguably, are more dramatic than in monetary terms than the resolution that you have in front of you. I don't know that that fact can give a person a great deal of reassurance that House Joint Resolution 8 would not be looked at pretty darn carefully by a court. I'm not predicting that a court would necessarily overturn it. Now, in the Bessie-Ulmer case, just factually, for those of you who have forgotten, that case involved four separate proposed constitutional amendments. The court overturned two of them, I believe, upheld one of them, and slightly rewrote the marriage amendment and sent that one to the voters. The court actually looked at those proposals before they were voted on by the people. So that's not to say that our Supreme Court would always elect to do that. It might be that the court would decide that they're not going to reach any questions regarding a proposed constitutional amendment until after it's approved by the people, and then they have it in front of them in that posture. However, in the Bessie-Ulmer case, the result of the litigation prevented two out of the three proposals from ever going to the people. And it is possible that that would be the posture we find ourselves in with respect to House Joint Resolution 8.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Just so that we can inject this with input from the public, we do have, is there anybody here in the room that wishes to testify on this? David, we're going to ask you in a moment your thoughts. We appreciate you being here. Is there anybody else in the room that wishes to testify on this? Mr. DeKotch?
No, thank you.
That's all right. We do have Dana Olson online. She's, are you with us, Dana?
Yes, sir, I am.
If you just introduce yourself for the record, we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dana L. Olson, and I live in Kinnick, Alaska. And I'm here on another bill, but in listening to this bill, I'm really quite concerned because the interpretation of the mineral estate is what I'm hearing you discuss, and I own a greater property interest in the state of Alaska because I own oil and gas, and I can sell my oil and gas, and I proposed that to DNR. So I'm hearing some language and an interpretation of the mineral entry. It was proposed to DNR in this fashion that unless the Constitution prohibits me from offering to sell my oil and gas to DNR, that it was lawful. And I am still waiting for DNR to facilitate a decision on that. I want to say that the legislature enacted Title 38, which had in their closed mineral orders in a land use plan, and the interpretation of closed mineral orders has not been addressed by this bill, and I raised the issue of Senate Bill 196, 1987. The legislature took a Supreme Court decision and codified it, and you know, Alaska Survival versus DNR is a federal pipeline standard. And you might wonder what an agricultural homestead had to do with the pipeline standards, because oil and gas was always combined with regional land use planning. Senate Bill 196 is where you severed oil and gas from...
Dana, we want to stay on HJR8. We don't want to go on a field trip.
What I'm trying to say is the mineral thing is being addressed here today. And the constitutional budget reserve, I find that really a problem, because the reason DNR was selling land to begin with and that the legislature set up was for DNR to have the money and not the legislature.
Okay. We thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
I don't see any questions here at the table for you. We appreciate your feedback. With that, we're going to close public testimony and then invite David to come up here and answer any questions that the legislature may have. Representative Gatto has a question, and you know, David's been. David, how many years have you been with the Finance Committee?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's going on 12.
12 years, so a lot of institutional knowledge. David, if you'll just introduce yourself for the record, and then Representative Gatto has a question either for you or for Derek.
David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division.
Welcome. We're honored to have you here before our committee. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, the question is for Tam. Tam, are you still online?
I am, through the chair. I am still online.
Okay, and I was intrigued by some of the comments about the constitutionality of what we're doing. And immediately my attention went to the Permanent Fund Corporation, which is a subdivision of the state somehow, either chartered or allowed, but somehow it is under our care. Is that correct?
The Permanent Fund Corporation has been established, I believe, as a public corporation in statute.
Okay, and since they decide, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, since they decide on the way to calculate the dividend using the five-year rolling average, is that a precedent that allows the state then to say, hey, we've been doing this for quite a while, or is the Permanent Fund Corporation different enough that they would be entitled to do it outside of our jurisdiction?
If I may, through the chair, the Permanent Fund Corporation, in the way that it handles income of the permanent fund, it is given direction specifically by statute. The corporation itself has very little discretion on how it handles income of the permanent fund, essentially none. It's all set out by statute.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, Tam, but I'm more interested in how they disperse the permanent fund dividend using a average of 5 years, and House Joint Resolution 8 is using a similar tactic of averaging over preceding and forward-looking year. So are they on a legitimate framework because we already have precedent for having done it, or is the Permanent Fund Corporation out of line for using that procedure?
If I may, through the chair, the Permanent Fund Corporation has to calculate an amount that is called the amount available for distribution, and it is an amount of the net earnings of the permanent fund itself, that then they have to apply. They have to figure out what the net earnings are and then determine an amount available for distribution. That's what the statute calls it. And that amount is based on 21%. It's an average of 21% rather than 20%. But fundamentally, it's a five-year average. You're correct. But that's set out in statute. Once the Permanent Fund Corporation does the math to obtain the number that is the amount available for distribution each year, then it is directed to transfer 50% of that amount from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund. Now, that transfer actually occurs through the appropriation process. The legislature, the permanent fund notifies the legislature of what amount it would be to be the 50% of the amount available for distribution, which is the amount that that the statute says ought to be transferred to the dividend fund. The legislature appropriates that money to the dividend fund, and generally not in a specific amount. It's often in the amount that is determined to be appropriate under the formula. And once it's in the dividend fund, it is actually the Department of Revenue, the dividend division, that determines the amount of dividends for the year. And that's based on the amount that ends up in the fund, the amount that they kept in the fund that hasn't been distributed for prior year dividends. And there is a reason that sometimes they have a balance. Sometimes they end up with money that they recover for whatever reason, and they also have obligations to keep a little bit of money available for people who apply after they're 18, for example, and if no one's applied for them. There's a couple of categories that requires a little bit of extra money to be kept in the dividend fund. But ultimately, it's actually the dividend division that will notify the people of the state regarding how much the dividend will be every year. And it's based on a determination of population and the number of people who apply.
Thank you, Tam.
But all of that is completely set in statute.
Thank you, Tim. Representative Gruenberg has a question.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Aaron.
I understand what's going on. It may not look like it, but I do.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Aaron.
To the sponsors, representative there, has this ever been tried in statute?
Representative Aaron, through the chair, this has been tried many times in my research in statute. Several, even your current members of the current body have tried this in previous legislatures. And to your question, this is the third time the sponsors introduced this bill.
The resolution, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, is to go to the vote of the people, but proposed legislation to put it in statutes have attempted many times.
Representative Heron, through the chair, to put it in statute and not a constitutional amendment? Is that your question?
Yes.
I'd have to check up on that, Representative Heron. Not that I'm aware of off the top of my head, but there have been efforts.
Thank you.
Representative Holmes first, and then Representative Cumbert.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have trying to understand how this works. I have two questions.
Sure.
Until those give rise to further ones. The first one, and I don't know whether this is to the sponsor's representative or to Mr. Thiel, but I'm just trying to understand. I'm reading how this thing works, and starting on the bottom of page 1, going on to page 2, it talks about the four full calendar years that immediately precede the current fiscal year, and the first full calendar year that's part of the current fiscal year based on estimates. And then I'm looking at the graphs from the PowerPoint, and it's talking about five-year averages, but it's referring to fiscal years. So are we talking about averages of fiscal years that appear to be on the graph or calendar years? And I'm getting a little confused as to what years get averaged and when the estimates come in for the final year and when you know and how the estimates match up with reality, I guess is where I'm going.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, in drafting this bill, the sponsor was also confused with that language, and we did
good, I'm in good company.
We did work with Tam Cook on this, so instead of me confusing you, it might be best to ask Tam about that and have her clear that up for you.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd love it if Tam could make that clear to me.
Tam?
Hi. Through the chair, this is Tamara. The question, if I understand it, is how the formula works.
Correct.
Okay, and that would be the formula that limits appropriations of these revenue sources.
Mr. Chairman, if I could clarify.
Yes.
Tam, this is Representative Holmes. My question is, I'm a little confused about the calendar years versus fiscal years and how that's calculated and how you figure out which calendar years line up with which fiscal years and when the the most recent of those 5 years.
Oh, pardon me for a moment.
Yep.
Guess who's here? It's all the close-up guys have come to join us in our committee. We're so excited. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just trying to figure out the calendar years versus fiscal year idea, and then also specifically when you go to appropriate that the most recent year that you're in, at what point are we getting forecasts? Are we working on forecasted numbers before we actually know how much money actually does come in that year, if that makes sense?
Through the chair, yes, that does make sense. And so what we have essentially, I think we're looking at the very first section of the bill, is that we're going to be doing a determination of the amount that is available for appropriation by looking at receipts during calendar year periods, calendar years that precede the current fiscal year, so that there is a six-month gap, you might say, built in there. But first we're going to be choosing our four calendar years that immediately precede the current fiscal year. So the fiscal year will include half of a calendar year. That calendar year isn't included. It's the four before that. And then we will add an amount that is going to be based on the estimate of what the what money will be generated to the state during the first full calendar year that is part of the current fiscal year. The first full calendar year that is part of the current fiscal year. So that would be the year...
Mr. Chairman, can we put this in context of, for instance, right now we're writing the fiscal year 11 budget. So what calendar years would we be looking at for to determine the fiscal year 2011 budget? Might make it a little clearer to me.
Representative Ramirez, may I answer that?
Sure. Go ahead, Derek.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, if you're talking about FY11,
yes,
and we're in 2010,
yes.
So the graph that you have, slide 14 and 15, it goes back to last year. So maybe it's better I use last year's graph here, just
okay,
so that we're all following along here. And on slide 15 there, you're talking about calculating the five-year average for the FY10 budget, which we're all, last year, that's what we were doing.
Yeah.
So it's March, April 2009. We have the figures going back four calendar years, FY08, FY09.
See, now, Mr. Chairman, that's where I get confused.
Right.
Because we're talking here on the graph about fiscal years, but you're telling me that it's actually calculated on calendar years. That's where I kind of went sideways.
Okay.
Derek? Mr. Miller?
Representative Holmes, through the chair.
Thank you.
That's a good question, Representative Holmes. I'm not sure I can articulate it. I know it in my head, but I
can you stand by for a second? So we're so happy to have the high school close-up students join us. We're delighted to have you here in the room. I mean, just for your benefit, because we're so glad that you're taking some time to get involved, because it's the most important thing. This is what we're talking about, is your future. Assembled here at the table is Representative Lynn from Anchorage, Representative Gruenberg from Anchorage, Representative Heron is a Republican is a Democrat from Bethel. I'm a Republican and the chair from Fairbanks. Representative Dahlstrom is a Republican from the Eagle River area. Representative Holmes is a Democrat from the Anchorage area. And Representative Gatto is a Republican from the Palmer area. And we have before us House Joint Resolution. It was offered by Representative Kelly. He came and presented the bill for the first 15 or 20 minutes. We did a PowerPoint presentation, which is what Representative Holmes and Mr. Miller, who's the Chief of Staff for Representative Kelly, are discussing. David Teal is an expert who's the Finance Director for the last dozen years, so he's here for us, and we're taking up a constitutional amendment that if it were successful and passed through both bodies of the legislature with a two-thirds vote, right? Two-thirds? Rules Chair?
Yes, sir.
Two-thirds vote, then it would go on the ballot in November for us to, in essence, create a balanced budget requirement in the year 2012. And so the question that Representative Holmes is engaged with Derek Miller from Representative Kelly's staff is our calendar year, our fiscal year, you guys know the calendar year starts on January 1st and ends December 31st. But the state's fiscal year starts on July 1st and runs through June 30th. So for instance, we are already inside of the, we're in the 2011 calendar year right now. Is that right, David? Are we in the 2010 year?
No, my chairman. If I may, we're now lined up because we're in calendar year 10. We're also in fiscal year 10. It only gets confused from July through
December 31st.
Right. We're in the same half of the year.
We're calendar year and fiscal year are in alignment. We're both in 10.
And then on July 1st of 2010 is when we enter the is when we enter the 2011 fiscal year. Is that correct?
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Right. So the question that you have is the alignment of the income for in a calendar year versus the fact that we're still on a fiscal year. You're concerned,
yes,
that there isn't an alignment, that we're not contending with half year. We're actually like a corporation, like a C corp versus an S corp. You know, an S corp is generally on a calendar year, and a C corp can choose any time of the year that they want. If I'm correct in my accounting law, and I'm not sure that I am, but
go with it.
So that's the nature of your question. Is that right?
That's generally speaking the nature, Mr. Chairman.
And I want to remind members that we're looking at this through the lens of the Judiciary Committee, which is due, you know, and I don't want us all to play finance members for the day, is my concern. David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To try to simplify this, what the intent, I believe, is to make it so that the legislature knows precisely how much is available to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So the calendar year fiscal thing would say, I want 5 years ending December 31st of 09,
mm-hmm.
as I'm in the 11 budget process.
Yeah.
So that for the 11 budget, which you're working on right now, you would know 5 calendar years ending December 31st, 09, and you would know that before you began the legislative session, so you wouldn't be estimating 6 months of income or revenue.
I understand that. So because it's an average, it's 4 years look back plus 1 forward year of projection, you would add those up using a calendar year, and then you would apply that to the fiscal year. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, because as you average, well, 5 years, whether you average calendar years or fiscal years is going to be pretty close to the same
correct.
Thing. The point is that you will know on January 15th or whenever it is you convene what the amount available to spend is by using calendar years. If you use fiscal years, you would either have to back all the way up and skip 6 months and end with fiscal year 9, or what they did was to say, we want to include the latest information we have. It really wouldn't make a whole lot of difference. And I say that because the whole concept here is smoothing volatility. And what it means is that if you looked at this thing over a 50-year period, you would be spending all of your revenue, or could spend all of your revenue.
Right.
It's just that at any given time, if you get a peak in revenue, you couldn't spend it that year. It would be averaged in, and you would spread that spending out. Same way, if you're low, you would not be constrained by the amount of revenue available to you. You could borrow or transfer some from this budget reserve account, or what's it called?
Balanced budget account.
But I think that's only half the objective, if I understood the bill sponsor. Half of it was smoothing volatility in high years versus low years, but the other half of it was trying to control spending at a fixed rate of 3% when we have a budget that's growing, I don't know, 10% or 8%. So I thought there was a dual purpose. Is that correct, Eric?
Representative Remmers, Mr. Chairman, yes, that would be correct.
Let me let David finish the thought, and then Representative Grunberg.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think to see that side of it, you need to understand that although you've got a constitutional budget reserve account, it does not limit your spending, other than the fact that you need a 3/4 vote to get the money out of it. But given a large balance in there and the ability to obtain a 3/4 vote, the spending limit, well, there is no spending limit other than the current $10 billion in the Constitutional Budget Reserve account. This joint resolution tries to say that your spending is constrained by the amount of revenue, not in any 1 year, but an average, so we smooth out the volatility. But it's truly a spending limit, whereas, as right now, your limit's constrained by both revenue and the balance available. So, in theory, this balanced budget account will never have very much money in it, because in a peak, you put some in, but when you're below the average, you pull it back out. And over a long period of time, you simply spend everything that's available to you. But that's the key. It's everything that's available to you, so that it's a spending limit because it says your ability to spend is tied to the amount of revenue that you have, as opposed to a limit like we have now, it's unrelated to revenue. It's related to an arbitrary number and growth in population and inflation, which may be much more than you have available or maybe much less than you have available. But if you're trying to have a balanced budget, your limit needs to be related to the amount of revenue available to you.
Representative Grimberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Folks from close up, for you to understand what we're talking about, it's probably a good idea in your packet for you to pull out the bill itself so you can see what we're talking about, and it's a two-page bill that you can have in there. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I'd like to ask a few questions, if I may.
Yes, under the condition that you will point out to Kayla that even with the 90-day session, we had time to slow down and offer a little civics time for our close-up students. Because at the debate we had at the Lusac Library, she suggested that under the 90-day session, we wouldn't have time to do this. And so I am delighted that you're demonstrating that, in fact, we do have time to slow down and offer a lesson in civics. So with deference to Kayla, please continue, Representative Grunberg.
Kayla's my wife, as you guys know. First, with respect to Representative Herron's real question of whether we could do something like this, I think he was asking, in statute. I think the language on page 2, lines 9 and 10, money may not be appropriated from the account. That's a limit on the appropriated power of the legislature, and I think we could only do that by Constitution. Through the chair, Ms. Cook, am I not right in what I just said?
Tam?
Through the chair, I believe you are correct.
Secondly, Mr. Chair,
Representative Grimm,
if the members would look at their handy constitutions, I'm afraid you guys don't have it. I'll read you what I'm talking about here. If you look on the bill, page 2, lines 12 to 13, the sentence reads, Section 7 of this article does not apply to money deposited into, et cetera, the balanced budget account. There is similar language in Article 9, Section 17A, which deals with the budget reserve account. Quote, Section 7 of this article does not apply to deposits made into the fund under this subsection. There's no similar language in Article 9, Section 15, concerning the permanent fund, Alaska Permanent Fund. Now, Article 9, Section 7 basically prohibits dedicated funds. This is again through the chair to Ms. Cook. Should we not have an amendment to the permanent fund statute that specifically says Article 9, Section 7 does not apply to it? I know that was not the intent, but is there a deficiency there through the chair?
I didn't get that question either, just in case any of you guys are wondering if you're a reason that you're not getting it. But that's why we have our legal, the person who runs our legislative legal department is on the phone. That's Tam Cook. And so she's going to not only answer the question for Representative Grunberg, but make it understandable for the rest of us at this table also. Because we only have two attorneys, who I think very highly of. Representative Holmes is an attorney. Representative Grunberg is an attorney. The other five of us, thank God, are lay people.
And I got to say, on behalf of the Alaska Bar, the bar appreciates that they're not. Also. Anyway,
Tam, can you answer the question for Representative Grunberg?
Through the chair, if I understand the question, if I understood Representative Grunberg's question, it is: do we need to worry that that Section 15 of the same article, which deals with the Alaska Permanent Fund, does not have a reference to Section 7 in it, which is the dedicated fund provision. Is that the thrust of your question, Representative?
That's correct.
You bet.
We don't need to worry about the permanent fund. We have our hands full, I think, with the current resolution. The permanent Section 7 itself contains a reference instead to Section 15. It says that the prohibition on dedicated funds does not apply to Section 15, which is the budget reserve fund.
Okay, so those of us, just for those of us that didn't understand the question, now believe that Tam Cook is right and that Representative Grunberg was on an expedition into the law.
And I, Mr. Chair, I stand chastised.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the question that we got from Representative Grunberg is completely legitimate. I chose as a drafter not to amend Section 7 again, but by changing Section 7 in order to avoid changing an additional section of the Constitution. This was just a drafting technique. Instead, I embedded the exemption from the dedicated fund within this new section that I am creating. And it could have been drafted the other way, and that is, in fact, what the permanent fund did. They went in and amended Section 7 at that time. So it's a completely legitimate question.
Tam, I think that's quite clear to all of us assembled here at this table. Representative Grunberg has a follow-up question.
Yeah, my third area, I believe, was your concern about the Bess v. Ulmer case, where they struck down one constitutional amendment dealing with criminal law on the basis that it amended a whole bunch of different sections and changed many things in the Constitution. And you can't do that in the single amendment to the Constitution. You either have to have the people vote on and the legislature on a series of amendments or have a constitutional convention. And you were saying, I think, Tam, that that there at least was an issue on that in this particular proposed constitutional amendment. And this is as much a statement as a question. It seems to me this does not do anything nearly like that. It's simply like the bucket analysis here. It's not upsetting whole areas of the Constitution. What I really wanted to ask was in something else, and this is also in Section 17 on the Budget Reserve Fund, subsection. If a little leeway here, Mr. Chair, please. We don't get many constitutional amendments on these difficult fiscal provisions in the Constitution, so I'm asking the ledge legal a question that is similar, but you'll see. Section 17D says, and this concerns the Budget Reserve Fund, that until an appropriation from the Budget Reserve Fund is repaid to the Budget Reserve Fund by the legislature, the amount in the general fund available for appropriation must be deposited in the Budget Reserve Fund. So there's a mechanism for repaying the money. And it says the legislature shall, it means must, implement this subsection by law. My question is, since, as I understand it, and Mr. Took, through the chair, correct me if I'm wrong, we still owe money to the Budget Reserve Fund, do we not?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we currently owe a little over $400 million to that reserve fund, and the supplemental bill submitted by the governor would repay that in full in FY10.
Okay. So my question is more a theoretical one. Could a court, do you believe, and would a court likely, upon application, order the legislature to do that or issue an injunction prohibiting the expenditure of funds for another source until that money is repaid? This is more of a hypothetical than anything else, but it's an important question. Ms. Cook, through the chair.
Through the chair, this is Tamara Cook again. It sounds to me like we're no longer really discussing the resolution in front of you, but rather what a court would do to ensure that the Budget Reserve Fund, standing on its own, is ultimately repaid. Am I correct?
Right.
And the answer, I believe, is nothing. The court would do nothing. There isn't an obligation to repay inherent in Section 17. What we have is a mechanism where money is going to automatically flow into until repayment is achieved. We've got we've got under subsection D, a built-in way that money would flow into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, but there is no obligation that the legislature actually appropriate or take any other steps to repay the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund.
Precisely. All right, so members, let me get a sense of where we're at. It's 2:15. We do have another piece of legislation, and we have people that are standing by to offer testimony. I have heard a very robust discussion here, and we thank David and Tam Cook for participating. And although this is fraught with considerations of for the Finance Committee and a vote of the people, I have found that it is in fact compliant with the State of Alaska Constitution. So unless there is a serious objection that in some way we're violating the State of Alaska's Constitution, I would request of the members to offer any concluding remarks or final questions for David Thiel or for Derek Miller or for Tam Cook, and then we can proceed either to amendments or to a vote to move this House Joint Resolution through the committee. We all know that the test for a constitutional amendment, the bar is extraordinarily high. It has to go through both bodies and enjoy a two-thirds vote before on each floor before it can even go to the people. And so I would ask us to narrow the test to its constitutionality here in the Judiciary Committee. Are there any final thoughts on this, Representative Holmes?
Just to say, Mr. Chairman, that I still am not 100% sure that I understand it, and so I'm not necessarily comfortable.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess we've said a lot of words today, and I think the intent of that you've outlined is that does it pass a judiciary test? I think it does. Essentially, I would call the balanced budget reserve account is really just a mini CBR that's still under a three-quarters vote. And so, like the sponsor said, it is a day tank, again, requires three-quarter vote. And I would not object to moving it from committee with individual recommendations at the appropriate time.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think on behalf of the minority members here, this is not just a typical change of a word or a technical change or something. This is a fairly serious thing we're doing. I do not recall seeing this legislation. Derek, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't recall seeing this before us in this committee before. And I'd like to inquire through the chair of Representative Holm, would you like a little more time to study this over the weekend or something? And because I think that that's a matter of courtesy that we normally do if one of my members or your members wants to do it, and I just was wondering that we would respect that.
Duly noted, Representative Grunberg. Representative Holmes, the activity of the committee hinges on how you feel about H.J.R. 8. We are going to be backloading things for Monday, but I'm quite comfortable to allow for a little more time. Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, I do not fully understand the concept at this point. I came in with questions. I'm still not quite clear.
All right. Do you believe that we're going to take this to a vote on Monday? I'm not interested in having lengthy discussion on the finance mechanics that surround this. So I'm interested in narrowing this down to our scope as a Judiciary Committee. Do you want, today is Wednesday, do you want to hold this over till Monday?
I would appreciate it.
All right, so we are going to set this bill aside until Monday, and then we will dispatch it promptly on Monday. Mr. Thiel, we thank you for your very valuable time. Derek, we appreciate that. And if you will tell the bill sponsor that I believe that there are the votes on this committee to move this bill, and so we will anticipate doing so on Monday. After we give some of the members an appropriate amount of time to visit this and make and to make remarks and to possibly recommend amendments. David, thank you so much for coming down and being with our committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Just to say to the sponsor, we appreciate this and nothing personal. This is just to accommodate some questions. Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Representative Grunberg. It's only because there are witnesses.
Lots.
So we also, I'm told we have students from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta that came in. So for those of you that just came in, I'm a high school close-up graduate. I was here when I was 15 years old. I'm so excited to have you here. Let me make introductions again briefly. This is Representative Lynn. He's a Republican from Anchorage. This is Representative Grunberg. He's a Democrat from Anchorage. This is Representative Herron. He is a Democrat from the Bethel area, the YK area. I'm Representative Ramris. I'm the chairman of the committee. I'm from Fairbanks. This is the vice chair, Representative Dahlstrom, and she is from the Eagle River area. This is Representative Holmes. She's a Democrat from the Anchorage area. And this is Representative Gatto, who is from the Palmer area. We just were talking about House Joint Resolution Number 8, which is a constitutional amendment. For those of you that would be 18 or have older siblings who would be 18, the objective was to try and vote on this by November. And so we're take our charge very seriously to have a piece of legislation that might go to the people for a vote. And it was a cumbersome piece of legislation for some of our members to consider. Others of us got it right off the bat.
Mr. Chairman, you're going to be presenting it next time.
So with that, now we're going to move to another piece of legislation, which is much easier to understand. This is House Bill 146. Now, Jane Pearson, for those of you in the room, Jane Pearson and I work together. We've worked together for 5 years. She's brilliant, as everybody in this room would concur. And so Jane is our chief of staff for the Judiciary Committee, but in this case, she's also going to be presenting House Bill 146. And if somebody wants to pop outside, there should be some copies of House Bill 146 on that table, and we can pass those out to some of you that are in the room. And this is called an act relating to transfer restriction under trust interests. And so, Jane, if you can take us through this for the benefit of some of the young people that are in this room and for those of us that are assembled around this table. And then we have ready to testify on this bill, Doug Blottmacher, Jonathan Blottmacher, Dave Schaftel, people that we've heard from before, and then also Dana Olson, the person from the Wasilla, that called in, that offered some remarks on the constitutional budget item, or the House resolution for the constitutional amendment, actually is dialed in to speak on this particular piece of legislation. We have no other members from the public that are signed up to speak. Representative Grunberg.
Are we sure that we don't have anybody? Because some of the lawyers and I have talked who have concerns about Section 3 of the bill, the family law section. They're supposed to be.
Yes, I'm sorry. I have Jacob Sanaborn. Sanaborn, right, is available. So with that, Jane, if you would take us through this piece of legislation.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez. And this is House Bill 146, an act relating to transfer restriction on trust interests. The bill provides the following amendments. It clarifies the burden of proof, which a creditor must meet to establish that a transfer in trust was done with the intent to defraud a creditor. It clarifies that a spendthrift provision will apply to a trust if distributions are made under the exercise of discretion by a trustee who is not the settlor, whether or not the exercise of discretion is governed by the standard. It provides that a spendthrift provision in a trust will apply even though the trustee may distribute income or principal to the settlor to pay income taxes. It clarifies the beneficiary's interest in a trust, whether or not vested, that it is not considered a factor or economic circumstance in division of property subject to divorce. So Section 1 amends AS 3440-110B, the subsection that makes exceptions to the transfer trust restrictions allowed under the section. The B1 exemption requires that a creditor establish the criteria for exception by clear and convincing evidence. The B2 exception also makes a conforming amendment to reflect the additional material under B3. And B3 adds two exceptions. The paragraph allows a creditor to satisfy a claim out of the restricted trust interest if the trust requires its income or principal to be distributed to the settlor. The first new exception, B3, also allows a settlor to receive certain discretionary distributions made by the trustee who is not the settlor, and allows a settlor to receive certain discretionary, excuse me, I said that. Section 2 amends 3440110H and provides that a transfer restriction on a beneficiary's trust interest is enforceable even if the settlor has certain listed powers relating to the appointment, removal, and replacement of a trustee, trust protector, or an advisor. And Section 3 amends 3440110L and clarifies that if a trust has a transfer restriction, the beneficiary's trust interest is not subject to division at divorce or dissolution, whether or not the trust interest is vested. It clarifies that the trust interest is not considered a factor or economic circumstance in the division of property in a divorce or dissolution. And that's pretty much what the bill does.
Questions for Jane, Representative Grunberg.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern, as the folks in the who are sponsoring the bill know, on behalf of the family lawyers in this state, those who practice divorce law, is with Section 3. And Ms. Pearson, through the chair, this is not simply a clarification, is it? It's a complete change in this aspect of the law, isn't that true?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, it basically changes whether or not if it is vested in the trust. And that vestment, whether that is a factor in the division of property.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do you know whether isn't it true that this section, if enacted, would overrule some Supreme Court cases, would it not?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I'd prefer we use some of our attorney experts and call in that lifeline.
As Regis Philbin would say, it's your choice. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, other questions for Jane? What I'd like to do is I'd like to hear from Jacob
Sonneborn,
and then I'd like to hear from Dana Olson. Sonneborn is gone, okay? So I'd like to hear from Dana, but Dana, are you there? Is that correct?
I am here.
All right, and so Dana, it's a new piece of legislation. I'd like to have you introduce yourself for the record, but I'd really like you to narrow your testimony to the House bill that's before us and not attach it to other pieces of legislation that are not germane to the discussion that are before us today. And I'm really going to enforce that provision with you, okay?
First of all, I live in Kinnick, and references to me living in Wasilla, I don't live in Wasilla.
All right. It says here on the offline that it says Wasilla. So you have
mail
my apologies.
Address.
Yep, you have my apologies. So if
okay.
You
and it's my position that the legislature can't go in and create bifurcation of divorce without finality and then come back and change things after partial distribution. And it would be my position also, since I am involved with IRS, that IRS has exclusionary rules about how evidence is collected, and simply the state can't override the Internal Revenue Code and the criminal proceedings on that. It would be in my argument, I guess, that I would have a right to give a deposition to the Legislative Affairs Agency, because what you're doing is trying to interpret instrumentality and whether and other grants that the legislature has given, whether things are vested or not is not the issue. It's whether or not things are voidable. So you don't, under the 14th Amendment, have government deciding whether things are vested or not, because a lot of times in the states, the things are automatic. They, once something has come into fruition, it automatically vests, and you do not need someone approving it or a court approving it. I think that one of the things that I have found troublesome is when you do a bifurcated divorce and you know that it takes 7 years to separate and 7 years hasn't arisen yet, and you're trying to go in and distribute things based on it having happened, it creates a can of worms. It truly does. And so I'm going to have to, you know, say that if you want to address economic circumstance, I can't have appeals going on federally and have the legislature changing things while I'm on appeal and while I'm addressing IRS. I mean, I don't know what you expect of me. I could give you a deposition, but I have really unique property.
Representative Dahlstrom has a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Dana. Are you an attorney?
No, I'm representing myself.
Okay, so through the chair, the references that you previously have made are in reference to a private divorce or personal divorce that you're going through right now. Is that correct?
No. What was happened was the Superior Court granted a bifurcation of divorce without any of the historical property or any of the state public trust lands or any of the trusts that are federal that were set up, without any of these having come into fruition or they haven't come into being. They, you know, you're already out there having the court distribute things. Now, one of the things that you can't do is you can't use a clerk's deed in a divorce case when there's two Indian children on state land without a patent yet being issued. That's one thing I know you can't do. And yet, if you look today, you'll see that that has occurred. You know, it's like when a veteran is a kind of a unique person, because a lot of his assets are, you know, touchable. So when he goes in and he promises, and it's recognized in marriage and all the various ways, that, and the court recognizes it, that he gave me a state homestead, whether it's alienated or not, there is tangible property on it, and it's timber. So, you know, it's not futuristic, there's timber on it. And to go in and argue I separated from my own land was the most ridiculous argument I've ever heard. And I argued that on February 14th, 2007, before the Supreme Court. I said no person in the United States has ever been termed separated from their own property. And so I'm sitting here in limbo. I do not file federal income tax returns. I have alienation of my property. In fact, Representative Gruenberg has a conflict of interest with me because he was in the legislature when they passed Senate Bill 196, and he voted on that bill. In fact, I've even come to his office. If maybe years ago, if he pulls up his records, we'll see that he wrote letters differently than this bill supports. And I would like some privacy. I don't think I need a legislative divorce. I mean, it sometimes happens in the, you know, historically, it sometimes happens. But right now, I'm sitting here trying my best to understand why you don't believe that instrumentality, or when the legislature goes and does something through a land grant, why you think that you can just go in and use a statute to overcome all the things in all the years.
Dana, if you'll wind up your testimony, please.
Okay, well, my position is that unless you take a deposition, this law doesn't apply to me.
Okay, very good. Are there questions for Dana here at the table? Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olson, I'm sorry I don't recall having chatted with you, but I would like to answer, I think, one of your concerns here, that Section 3 of the bill refers to AS 344110, and that deals with private trusts. As I understand from what you've said, some of the land involved in your divorce is land with either a veteran's allotment or of some kind or a native allotment. That's not the kind of trust this section of law deals with. It doesn't deal with public land trusts like that, I'm afraid.
Thank you, Dana. Dana, this is not an exchange between you and Representative Grunberg. We thank you for your testimony, Representative Grunberg. We thank you for your remarks. Dana, you're welcome to stand by and listen, and we appreciate your testimony. This is not we're not interested in an exchange here. We thank you. I'd like to now go to Doug Blotmacher, please.
This is Doug Blotmacher.
Thank you, Mr. Blotmacher. Do you have are you available to answer questions, or do you have testimony to offer?
Chairman Ramos, I have just want to say that we support this legislation. We think it's good. It continues to keep Alaska in the forefront of being a jurisdiction for people to set up trusts. Since we first worked with the legislature in 1997, we have had thousands of trusts come to Alaska. We have over $2 billion in trust assets in our institution. The majority have come from individuals outside setting up trusts. A number of jobs have been established in the trust industry. Also, attorneys have added lawyers. There have been a lot more life insurance policies issued. We know from the life insurance policies that we've had through trust that the state has received many millions of dollars of increased in life insurance premiums over the years.
Thank you, Mr. Blotmacher. Can you tell us your affiliation?
I'm president of Alaska Trust Company.
Very good. Are there questions for Mr. Blotmacher?
I do.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes. Mr. Blotmacher, this is Max Grunberg. I've just been in contact with the co-chairs of the family law section who were until then unaware of the bill, and they have concerns about Section 3, and my questions will relate to Section 3. Do you know whether Section 3 would have the effect of overruling Alaska Supreme Court decisions?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I do not have that answer. I think probably Dave Schaftel would be a better one to be able to answer those technical questions.
We have Mr. Schaftel with us. Are there any more questions for Doug Blotmacher? Thank you very much, Mr. Blotmacher. Mr. Schaftel, can you introduce yourself for the record and your affiliation and offer an answer to Representative Grunberg, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dave Schaftel. I'm a member of an informal group of attorneys and trust officers and other professionals who have been working with you in the legislature, I think, since back in 1997 to recommend improvements in the state and trust statutes for Alaska, both for the benefit of Alaska residents, and some of these statutes are even used by non-residents of Alaska. I was involved in the drafting of this bill in recommending these provisions, and be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Yes, Mr. Shaftel. Had you had any contact with the folks in the family law section on Section 3 of the bill?
Through the chair and Representative Grunberg, Max, as you and I know, I came over and sat down with you, and we went over this bill item by item, and the other bills that are pending before the legislature. And at that time, you expressed some questions about this particular provision and asked that I notify the family law section of the bar, which I did. I wrote them a letter. And I wrote the co-chairs of the family law section, and that was back within a week of when you and I met, which was a month or two ago.
Right.
So I wrote to both of them and called their attention to all of the bills that were in front of the legislature and pointed out that some of the provisions affected their area. And so yes, I did do that. If I could perhaps expand a little bit here as to why we think this provision is important?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
First of all, through the chair, thanks for doing that. I talked to both of them today, and I don't know what happened, but they didn't seem to have any knowledge of this. I'd like to hear what you have to say, Mr. Shaftel, but I would like to ask a question first, if I may, through the chair, and that is, do you know whether Section 3 would overrule any Alaska Supreme Court cases?
I think it overrules an interesting concept. I think it does, but let me explain why. I think it was around 2006, the Alaska legislature passed this provision. And basically, what was explained about what the provision meant at that time was that it was intended that if a parent creates a trust for a child, as an example, and that child subsequently becomes involved in a divorce, that the divorce court cannot do one of either of two things, cannot reach into that trust that was created by the parent and divide up those assets and give those assets to the ex-spouse of, let's say, the daughter of that parent. Can't divide up those, can't reach into and divide up the assets of that trust. And many, I can speak for myself and also for, I think fairly for all of my fellow practitioners in the estate planning area, this is a major concern when families come in to do estate planning. They do not want their assets they are leaving to their daughter or to their son to be lost in a divorce. And this is probably the number one asset protection concern that my clients have expressed, and I've been at this for over 30 years. Now, the statute also at that time, the way it was presented to the legislature, did something else. It was intended to say not only can the court, the divorce court, which has, not only can that judge in the divorce court not reach into and take assets out of this trust created by mom and dad, but that divorce court cannot consider those assets when dividing up the assets between the daughter and her ex-husband. So let me give you an example. Let's say that one of you creates a trust for your daughter, and you intend this to be for your daughter and your grandchildren. You put $500,000 into it, and your daughter has been married for 4 or 5 years. She's working along with her husband, and the two of them accumulate $500,000 worth of assets. And then, unfortunately, the marriage breaks down, and there's a divorce. The judge cannot, under this statute as it was written in 2006, as we understand it, and under how it's clarified now, cannot say, well, okay, that daughter has $500,000 in a trust that mom and dad created for her, so we'll take the $500,000 that she and her husband both earned during the four or five years and give it all to the husband. We will, in other words, we will consider the assets that are in that trust created by mom and dad years ago for the daughter. We'll consider that when we're dividing up the daughter and her husband's property. And the statute said back in 2006, you can't do that. At least that's what we thought it said. It can't. You cannot. Not only can you not divide it, but you can't consider it when you're weighing how to divide up the assets. Now, it was brought to our attention by a practitioner in Colorado who works just in this area, and he reviewed the language, and he said that language ought to be bolstered. You know, we know what you intended to say, but I think you ought to bolster it. And that's why this is a clarification. We added the language, a factor or economic circumstance in the division of. But that was the intent when this statute was enacted by the legislature. And as I say, I think it was around 2006. Now, to directly, Representative Grunberg, to answer your question about overruling a Supreme Court case, interestingly, at the same time that the legislature enacted this provision, the Alaska Supreme Court decided that the Kreitz case, and these were really like ships passing in the night. We all noticed this, and we thought it was a very unusual circumstance. At the same time, without considering this statute, the Supreme Court decided the Kreitz case, in which it said that the court could consider trust assets in this kind of a setting. But they didn't have the statute in front of them. They didn't know about the statute. And the legislature at that time didn't know about the Kreitz case. Now, what my clients and what I hear from other practitioners, they find very offensive is the idea that you create a trust for your child, your daughter, and down the line, your daughter gets into a divorce proceeding, and if the trust that you create, you may have 3, 4, or 5 children, you have estate planning set up for all of them, you've done your own estate planning, yet your daughter who's in a divorce, now her ex-husband's lawyer, if we did not have a statute like this, her ex-husband's lawyer could subpoena you, take your deposition, subpoena all of your estate planning documents, examine all of them, and try and make an argument that the court should consider your estate planning in terms of your daughter's divorce, and your daughter is an adult, she is not living or dependent upon you, that's her life, not your life. And that's another aspect of this that at least Alaska clients of mine that I have heard from find that would be an extremely offensive type of invasion of their privacy and unnecessary. So that's kind of the background behind this one particular provision, which is in Section 3.
All right, follow-up, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've raised several points, if I may dialogue a bit. The statute dealing with divorce, which is not in front of us, and the division of property says that the court has broad equitable powers to divide assets and can only invade the separate property of one spouse where there are special equities, where the unusual circumstances require that they look at the separate property of one spouse. This is not the norm. This would probably not be considered joint property because it's either inherited or a gift, and they could only do it where the court makes a finding there's a special reason to invade the separate property of one spouse. This is not a typical circumstance. So the circumstance that you have postulated, where they're just going on a fishing expedition, would be very unlikely to occur and would probably be reversible error, because the spouse that didn't need the property would have no equitable claim upon the trust. In fact, it would normally be the opposite. It would be a circumstance where there's a wealthy guy or a woman, and the other person has either unable to work or children to raise or very little money, and would not allow the court to consider that in dividing the remainder of the property or possibly invading it. I think that if you were represent, first of all, the parent is not a party to the divorce. This is between the two spouses. And the parent doesn't have the right at that point to intervene in the divorce. They could not become a party to the divorce. The court could not look at them as a party, and their intention is frankly irrelevant to the divorce. They're looking at doing equity between the spouses here. And if there, for the same reason, if there was a subpoena on the parents' records, under the normal rule of the scope of discovery, that subpoena could be quashed.
Representative Groenberg?
Because it would be invasive. I'm going to ask him if he agrees here.
Excuse me, yeah. Acting as the chair currently. We have two more people online, attorneys who wish to testify. We have 9 minutes.
I'm sorry.
And the wish of the chair is to move the bill from committee today. So if you could summarize in the next minute.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Okay, thank you. This would involve, I'm sure, overruling more than this one case, because I do remember other cases on the subject. And I'll just leave it at that rather than going on so we have other people to talk.
All right, thank you. Mr. Cheftel, will you be able to remain online if there's any questions that are specifically for you?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Next person we have in line to testify is Michael Gershell. Michael, if you could identify yourself and your affiliation, please.
My name is Michael Gershell. I am a private family law attorney in Anchorage.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
And I'm sorry, I have no prepared comments. I just learned about this with the bill within the last hour and a half through an email.
Okay, so you were just dialing in to listen?
I originally actually dialed in. I was listening in on the early part of the discussion, and after hearing some of the discussion, with your permission, I just wanted to make a brief comment.
Oh, please go ahead.
I deal with a lot of my work deals with divorce law, and I'm a bit concerned about this trust issue sort of spilling over into family law. One of the prior witnesses had talked about the Community Property Act back in 1997, which was another case where, in an effort to drum up trust business from outside, they created a species of community property law, community property which did not previously exist in Alaska, and it was a case of altering family law as it existed. Because again, we don't otherwise have community property in Alaska. It was an effort to alter family laws that existed simply for the purpose of drumming up trust business without regard to its impact on family law. And this strikes me, and again, I apologize, I'm just sort of jumping in on the last half hour. This strikes me as another case where in an effort to benefit trust business, it's another attempt to rewrite what is done in the family courts in Alaska. I caught Representative Groomsburg's explanation of family law, and it's accurate. The courts have a fair amount of discretion in terms of equitable division of estate. The law, as I read it, already provided that trust and the existing 34.40.110L already provided that the trust itself would not be part of the estate, that is, upon division in a divorce, that is, it would not be on the table, would be not something that's counted against the person holding on to it, and where they would have to give an offset. But the law did allow, and currently still allows, the court to consider it, because the courts, with very few exceptions, mostly as a result of the supremacy clause in family law, in federal law, the court is allowed to consider assets, separate assets of one of the spouses, simply to reach an equitable result. If you have a situation, let's say, where the parties have, you know, a $1 million estate they've accumulated over the years, and somebody also has a separate asset of $100,000 that they brought into the marriage, or it's a trust, the court can consider that, but frankly, it's unlikely to affect their calculus in terms of weight. But you can certainly imagine a situation where the parties have not accumulated much over a long marriage, but one of them has a substantial trust. And to not consider the trust would essentially mean impoverishing one of the spouses upon divorce, whereas if you take that large asset that one of them holds in the trust into consideration, it would be justification for providing additional resources to the disadvantaged spouse. This is not a situation that's going to come up all the time. Trusts don't come up all the time, but the point is to have this provision in here is to take away the leeway and discretion for a trial court judge that in certain circumstances, on certain facts, could have a very strong and disparate impact on one of the spouses. And I don't see the need for taking away that discretion that a judge will sometimes have the need to exercise.
All right. Thank you very much. Next online to testify is Jacob Sonneborn. Jacob, are you with us?
Yes, I am. I am.
Please identify yourself and your affiliation and proceed.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jacob Sonneborn, and I am also a private practitioner of family law in Anchorage. I had initially logged on been patched in, like Mr. Gershell, to listen to the conversation and then called back in and asked to have a chance to comment. I also learned about this House bill only in the recent email that went out this morning, and I also do not have prepared comments. I also fear that that much of what I'm going to say is going to parrot exactly what Mr. Gershell, the points that Mr. Gershell has already made. I suppose, though, since I'm on the line, I would just point out that I think that it's already been stated, Representative Grunberg already noted that there's limited ability of the judges to take separate property into account, and I fear that the situation that Attorney Schaftel described of the $500,000 trust being held against the party holding that trust in such a way that the entire estate of the marriage, the $500,000 estate in that hypothetical that he described, would then go to the no-good son-in-law. With all due respect to Mr. Schaftel, that just does not happen.
Thank you. Mr. Sonneborn, can I interrupt you for a moment, please?
Yes, please.
I think I grasp your point, so I'd like to, as a layperson, what I'd like to do is ask Mr. Schaftel, what would happen if we delete Section 3? Which seems to deal strictly with the divorce component. And Mr. Schaftel?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand what would happen. I mean, you can do that. It would just be the existing law would be what I described earlier, which is quite frankly the same as what we've talked about. It just wouldn't be clarified.
All right, well, it's 3 p.m. I'm looking for consensus around this table. It seems that we have raised a problem with family law, and that the bill enjoys support at this committee table without Section 3, which deals with divorce. So if any of you gentlemen have anything in summary that you would like to add, I want to make it clear I'm going to offer an amendment. God bless you. I'll be looking for an amendment to be offered to delete Section 3 from this bill. So if anybody has any final thoughts or remarks on this, or if there are any questions from the members here, but that is the wish of the chair is to delete Section 3 and remove the ambiguity that comes with involving a divorce component in the rest of this trust bill. Are there any questions from members? It seems that there is some consensus at this table. With that, are there any questions for Mr. Blotmacher, Mr. Schaftel, Mr. Gershel, or Mr. Sonneborn from members here in the committee? Right, seeing none, I'm going to close testimony. I'm going to move to a discussion amongst the committee. Is there any discussion here amongst the committee members?
I do want a motion.
I'm going to look for an amendment. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to make a conceptual amendment, and that is that we remove Section 3 of the bill, which is on page 3, lines 28, following through page 4, line 8.
Thank you. So we have before us conceptual amendment number 1. Is there an objection to conceptual amendment number 1? Seeing no objection, conceptual amendment number 1 is adopted. Are there any other amendments here in the committee room? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Bill number 146 with conceptual amendment number 1, and that's number 26-LS0633/A with attached zero physical note and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, House Bill 146 passes from committee.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned at 3 o'clock. And just a final remark while we're on the record, because I just think it's material. I got an update on the domestic violence case that's rolling through my workplace, and the note that I got, we don't know the person, so I don't feel that we're compromising the identity of someone. The note that I got back from the front desk manager was, he has been beating her for 4 years, and the last straw was Thursday night when he grabbed the 2.5-year-old baby girl and threw her across the room. The gal finally had him arrested. She had finally worked up the courage to leave. She was going to a shelter out of town, and I hope she does not go back to him. I knew something was going on with her and kept asking if there was anything I could do. She finally came to talk to me last Friday. She got on a plane Sunday and took the children with her. So as we take up House Bill 298, there are real faces and real victims throughout urban Alaska, throughout rural Alaska. This is something that cuts all ways. And so on that somber note, we will take up that bill on Monday, and we will also take up HJR 8 with the intention of moving both of those bills. And then for the benefit of the members, on Thursday, we will have a committee hearing on Thursday. Thank you. And HB 316 on Monday as well. But on Thursday, we're going to take up the issue of identity theft, the 77,000 of Alaskans who are now getting letters from the state, and we're going to have a thorough discussion of how it happened, what remedies are there to what, how it's going to be prevented in the future, and what the remedy is for those 77,000 Alaskans, and whether 2 years is adequate. Because my understanding with the letters that people are receiving, it suggests that there's a 2-year period. And frankly, I don't know that that's adequate protection for the Alaskans that feel that their records were compromised. So we will, at that point, determine if after a hearing, whether we want to issue a letter from the Judiciary Committee and make inquiries either into process or remedy. So with that, at 3:05, we're adjourned.